It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Over the past year, Pennsylvania's Attorney General has tangled with UPMC, the largest agency dealing with college student loans, and with the manufacturers and distributors of legal opioids. According to the National Institutes of Health, 80% of illegal opioid users started on prescription drugs. The Confluence's Megan Harris sat down a few days ago with Attorney General Josh Shapiro.
Attorney General, let's start with the soon-to-expire consent decree between UPMC and Highmark. Quick background for our listeners. The agreement mandated in 2014 required that UPMC, a nonprofit healthcare giant, accept patients with any kind of insurance, including their main local competitor, Highmark. In February, you sued UPMC, asking them to treat all clients from all insurers indefinitely. UPMC countersued you for, quote, illegally taking over nonprofit healthcare in the state, end quote. The Commonwealth Court now says it can't force UPMC to give in-network rates to patients beyond June 30th, but it does agree that your office has the authority to regulate public charities like UPMC. What's your next move?
Well, was to ask the Supreme Court to take this up. Look, here's the deal. There's a lot of legal stuff going back and forth, but here's what your good listeners should know. UPMC gets billions and billions of dollars out of their pockets, right? Out of your pockets and mine, because they don't pay taxes. They don't pay taxes when they build these buildings. They don't pay taxes to Pittsburgh schools. And basically, the deal is when you don't pay taxes and you're a nonprofit here in Pennsylvania, you have a responsibility back to the citizenry, in this case, to provide accessible, affordable care. And they're denying people access to care. They are denying people that affordable care. And we took them to court because we think they are in violation of our state charities laws. The good news is the Commonwealth Court ruling came at a time that we can now appeal to the Supreme Court prior to the expiration of those consent decrees, prior to June 30th. And I know there's a lot of people listening who are stressed out not knowing what's going to happen after June 30th. We're trying to get them answers. And what's UPMC doing? They are spending an exorbitant sum of money on lawyers, on outside counsel, in order to earn the right to stop caring for certain people in Western Pennsylvania. That's what they're fighting for. They're fighting to deny people access to care. That's outrageous. And I think people here get that viscerally. We get it legally, and we're really confident in our case.
So what's your immediate goal? Is it to compel UPMC to treat patients with Highmark insurance, or is it in a way to challenge their status as a nonprofit?
Put it this way, I guess. I have an immediate goal of getting the Supreme Court to step in and at least just hit the pause button so that come June 30th, you know, the world doesn't come to an end for a lot of people who rely on healthcare for, you know, life-saving and important treatments and care. That's number one. And then number two, we'll spend a good bit of time back in Commonwealth Court arguing about what it means to be a nonprofit in Pennsylvania. I think if you take billions of dollars from the taxpayers, you don't pay taxes, and you have a charitable mission that talks about providing affordable, accessible care to people, then you better provide it. And so we'll spend a lot of time arguing that out. I'm confident in the hand we've been dealt. I think we're going to win that case.
With the Supreme Court, the Commonwealth Court Judge Robert Simpson ruled April 3rd, falling back on a Supreme Court ruling from 2018, that they didn't necessarily have the discretion to do that. Are you worried that that Commonwealth Court precedent might hurt your case in this coming discussion?
No, not at all. And the judge ruled at a time that was really helpful to us because he ruled in a way that allowed us the opportunity to go to the Supreme Court and get them to review it. So we're actually really happy with how things have turned out and how they're progressing. I'm hopeful that the state Supreme Court takes up this case and hears it. And look, consent decree or no consent decree, you're not allowed to violate the laws in Pennsylvania. And we believe UPMC is violating our charities laws.
We want to talk a bit about what your office has been doing among opioids. Last May, the city of Pittsburgh and Allegheny County filed suit against 8 pharmaceutical companies that make or distribute opioids. More than a year ago, you told my colleague Kevin Gavin, the usual host of this program, that you and more than 40 attorneys general across the nation were investigating the possibility of a suit against the makers of prescription painkillers. Has anything come of that investigation?
A lot has come of it. Not much that I can talk about in this setting, but I can tell you we continue to be one of the lead states out of 41 states investigating 6 manufacturers and 3 distributors. My goal is twofold. Number one, to recover for the people of Pennsylvania. And number two, to change corporate behavior so that these big pharmaceutical companies can no longer turn a blind eye to the addictive nature of opioid painkillers or any other medication for that matter. And that they don't turn a blind eye to the extraordinarily high number of prescriptions that they're dumping into communities across Pennsylvania, particularly rural communities in Pennsylvania.
Would you call it a blind eye when it seems like they're keeping a pretty close eye on their bottom line, at least?
Well, they're keeping a close eye on their bottom line. But if you turn a blind eye to the addictive nature, you know that it's addictive and you don't tell people that, there's something very, very wrong with that. And we're going to hold you accountable. And I realize it's a little frustrating to some. They don't exactly know what's going on with our investigation. It's not something we can be public about right now. We're in a position now where we're doing that hard work, and I hope to have more to be able to say about this publicly. Look, combating opioids and heroin and fentanyl and the death that comes from it, the 15 Pennsylvanians we lose every single day as a result of drug overdose, this is my top priority, and it is something we work hard on every single day. And I think we're making some progress, but we've got a lot more work to do.
When you say recover for Pennsylvanians, are you talking about potentially monetary penalties or damages of some kind?
Yes, I think we need to recover monetarily for, you know, for example, the drug office or the office of, you know, of children and youth in Allegheny County that's had to bear a larger burden as a result of the opioid epidemic, the ambulances that are out of money because of the number of runs they're making to and from hospitals, all of the different services the government provides that I think deserves to get some resources back for. And then, of course, the individuals who are out of pocket for this treatment. So we want to make sure that both resources come back to the Commonwealth and also that we have a change in corporate behavior. Now, I do want to touch on the Oklahoma settlement recently, because a few people have said, wait a second, Oklahoma got $250 million.
Why not Pennsylvania?
Yeah, why not Pennsylvania? So let's just dissect that really quickly. Of the $250 million, $60 million went to attorney's fees, $12 million went to cities and counties, zero went to the state, and the rest went to a foundation that's going to help be set up by the Sackler family, the family that runs Purdue Pharmaceuticals. If I brought that deal back to Pennsylvania, I think you would skewer me on this program. That's a bad deal, and it's a bad deal for the Commonwealth and not one I would make. I would also point out to your listeners, we're relying on counsel within our office, not outside counsel. And so for every dollar that we're able to recover for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, that full dollar will make its way back to helping support the government and the people of the Commonwealth.
Do you imagine that this could ultimately result in changes in how corporations are allowed to market these pharmaceuticals?
I hope so. I hope there's a lot of corporate change that comes. And that's, again, part of what we're working through here. It is a slow process. It's a challenging one.
Do you know when you might be able to say more candidly?
I can't say right now at this time. And I hope it'll be a short-ish period of time. How's that for a technical answer?
We'll take what we can get. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, and our guest is Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro. And of course, you're in Pittsburgh with us now to talk about the student loan crisis. Mm-hmm. According to Forbes magazine, Pennsylvania college grads have an average loan debt of just under $36,000. It's the second highest in the country, just behind New Hampshire. And it keeps them from being able to afford other milestones like home ownership or starting a family if they wish. What can the Commonwealth do differently to protect its would-be college goers from this kind of debt so early in their working lives?
I think, look, we need to be serious about investing in higher education. And I think more money needs to go into higher ed to offset the cost coming out of students' pockets. But
is that something the Attorney General's office can do?
I was just about to say that is really outside the scope of my authority. Mm-hmm. Within my authority, here are specific steps we are taking to ease the burden. We conducted a long investigation. We announced a lawsuit against Navient. Navient is formerly Sallie Mae. And we allege in our lawsuit that they added $4 billion, that's with a B, $4 billion of excess cost and interest and what have you to students and their families here in Pennsylvania and across the United States as a result of their predatory practices. And we sued them, and we're going to recover for the good people of Pennsylvania on that. That's an example where we can hopefully put some money back into people's pockets. We've also been very aggressive on dealing with for-profit colleges that just shut down abruptly, leaving students with a lot of debt and a worthless degree or worthless credits that they can't transfer to some other school. We've actually seen that happen a lot here in the Pittsburgh area recently, and we're working with a number of students to help them get their money back or be able to transfer their credits. At the federal level, there are laws in place, there are rules in place that protect student lenders. And Betsy DeVos, who's the Secretary of Education, mm-hmm. has actually tried to change those rules and shockingly tipped them in favor of the student loan companies or the for-profit colleges instead of the students. And we've taken her to court, successfully, I might add, in order to protect the students here in Pennsylvania. It's a big priority of mine. We all suffer because of this high student loan debt rate, and it's something that we got to get serious about. Listen, I'm 45. I'm the Attorney General of Pennsylvania. I still pay student debt, even as I begin now to think about how to afford to send our first child. We have four, but our first child off to college. These are serious issues that last with us for decades, and it's something that I think we all have to take seriously.
You came to WESA today from a roundtable at the University of Pittsburgh. What did you hear from students? And do you feel like, you know, as a 45-year-old still paying his own debt, that you're able to offer them any real hope?
Well, I offer them concrete actions that were taken. I mean, we had, you know, people there who would benefit from our lawsuit against Navient. We had a couple of folks there who had gone to a for-profit college and really got harmed as a result. And we're working with them to get them some of their money back. And so I was able to not only connect with them and talk about ways we're specifically helping them get some money back, but also, when I hear their stories, that fuels me to go continue to keep up this fight and look out for them. And so I think hopefully, as you've seen from my work over these 2 years as your Attorney General, I'm not a guy who likes to sit behind a desk all the time. I do my fair share of that and, you know, reading and making decisions and what have you. But I like to get out with people and listen to them. And it helps me do my job putting people before powerful institutions and doing that important work for them every day.
As you look at your office and what you've tried to accomplish in the last 2 years, some have said that you and many other AGs across the country are kind of shifting the role, the scope of the office itself, weighing into more political battles and exerting pressure where maybe you don't necessarily have strict authority. Is that what attorneys general, what the office demands now?
No, I would respectfully differ from your characterization of our work. I certainly don't inject politics into our work, and I don't weigh in on something because it's political. I weigh in when it violates the law. Perhaps I've got a bit of a higher profile in this work than maybe others are used to, but it's my job to go out and fight for them every day. And so I'm going to use my voice, but most importantly, I'm going to rely on the law to go out and protect them day in and day out. I think in the past, our office was known for, you know, pretty good criminal work, but wasn't always known as a protector of consumers. And I made a priority when I was running for this office to go out and protect consumers and be really aggressive in that area. And so I think some of the work I'm doing may be new to people, but it's always within the bounds of the law, and it's always within the scope of my authority. And we really don't waver from that. You won't hear me commenting on the political issues of the day. I really don't do that. What I do is use my voice to stand up and fight for the people of Pennsylvania day in and day out.
Do you think that perception of at least increased collaboration is true of the office, at least for now?
Oh, without a doubt. We collaborate with our federal partners in law enforcement. For example, I was with a number of our federal partners talking about the opioid epidemic early this morning in my office in Pittsburgh. We collaborate very well with them. And I collaborate with attorneys general all across the country to deal with issues. I mean, I you guys might cover a lawsuit that we file against President Trump more than you cover maybe a collaborative effort with attorneys general on other issues. But I would tell you probably 80% of what I do with other attorneys general is nonpartisan and has nothing to do with President Trump. And by the way, where I do weigh in and sue the president, and I've done it 22 times, I would note some of my colleagues. Some of my colleagues have done it 100 times. I've done it 22 times. I've never lost. And the reason why we've never lost is because we focus on the rule of law, not some political battle or not some policy difference, but the rule of law. The lion's share of the work we do with other attorneys general is totally nonpartisan, usually consumer based, sometimes with a criminal focus, you know, dealing with the opioid crisis. But it is the work we do using the rule of law to protect the people of Pennsylvania day in and day out that we're most proud of.
And Attorney General is, of course, an executive level row office. That begs the question. Governor Wolf is term limited. You've won statewide elections. Do you plan a run in 2022 for governor?
Yeah. I love this job, and I'm going to keep doing it as long as the people of Pennsylvania will let me. And I'm up for re-election in 2020, so I'll have a conversation with my wife and our four kids and make sure they're cool with me going again. But I can tell you, I've never felt more of a sense of personal satisfaction in the work I do every day. I think I'm getting results for the people of Pennsylvania. And I'm sure there's people listening today who disagree with some of the things I've done. But I hope they know I'm fighting my tail off every single day for them. And I'm blessed to have this opportunity to do this work. I'm someone who, you know, who draws on my faith and believes very deeply that, you know, no one is required to complete the task, but neither are we free to refrain from it. And while that is a passage from my faith, I think that is something universally understood, that we all have a responsibility to do our part, to, you know, get off the sidelines, get in the game, and make a difference in life. And to have the opportunity to try and make a difference in life as the Attorney General I'm so grateful to the people of Pennsylvania for this opportunity. I get a little emotional talking about it. So it's something that that I'm grateful for, and I hope I'll be able to do it for a long time.
Well, we thank you for coming in today. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro, thanks for making time for The Confluence.
Thank you.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. For many families who have a child with autism, preventing wandering, especially at night, is a major concern. We'll hear from the creator of a bed who keeps kids with autism safe at night. Then, a new exhibit at the Heinz History Center explores the roots of the Vietnam War. Visitors can see artifacts from combat soldiers and documents from the anti-war movement right here in Pittsburgh. Just ahead, we'll talk to two Vietnam War veterans and the curator of the new exhibit. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
Grammy Awards? Who needs them? In January of last year, Kendrick Lamar lost the award for Album of the Year to Bruno Mars. It was the third time Lamar had been nominated for the very prestigious award, and the third time he lost. Fast forward to 1 year ago today, and Lamar made music history when his album Damn won the Pulitzer Prize for Music. Not only was it the first time that a rap artist won the award, but also the first time it wasn't given to a classical or jazz musician. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar. I feel like a chip on my
shoulders. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For many families who have a child with autism, preventing wandering, especially at night, is a major concern. At 2 a.m., parents are asleep, and kids might get into any number of dangerous situations. As part of our Built in PGH series, 90.5 WESA Sarah Bowden visits a Gibsonia-based manufacturer, which produces a type of bed to keep these kids safe.
The safety sleeper looks a lot like a tent that fits over a mattress, only instead of waterproof polyester, it's constructed with medical-grade fabric.
This is our twin-size model.
Rose Morris is the owner and founder of Abrams Nation, which makes the safety sleeper. She shows me around the showroom of her company's headquarters.
And then we've got the frame pads on the side covering up the frame. This is designed in case a child is self-injurious.
Morris created the first safety sleeper for her son Abram in 2007 when he was 2.5 years old. Abram is on the autism spectrum and has some special needs. For example, Morris explains that kids with autism sometimes bang their heads because their nervous systems are over or understimulated, which is why the metal frame is padded.
So that they can't harm themselves.
Can I touch it?
Yeah, absolutely. You can lie down.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I'm going to take off my shoes. The inside is comfortable. The safety sleeper's canopy top is constructed of a mesh material, so I don't feel caged in. Another feature is that zippers on the safety sleeper can only be accessed from the outside, which prevents kids from getting up and wandering when they're supposed to be in bed.
Actually, let's get the full experience.
Okay.
I'll just give you a zip up.
Yep, I was stuck.
And now, so I'll see you in a few hours.
Okay.
And enjoy your nap.
People with autism and certain other conditions tend to have irregular sleep patterns, as was the case with Abram.
He would spin around in his room and bang himself into the wall. He would throw himself on the floor and roll across the floor.
Another issue was that Abram, like a lot of kids, wouldn't stay in his room when he was awake at night.
He wouldn't shut down. He didn't turn off.
The National Autism Association reports that nearly half of all kids with autism engage in wandering behavior. Drowning is a major concern as many kids gravitate towards water. The association says wandering also puts them at higher risk for sexual assault, getting hit by a vehicle, or dying from exposure. Before creating the safety sleeper, Moore says she felt like a prisoner in her own home because she was too afraid to take Abram anywhere overnight and she was exhausted.
It was getting dangerous because, God forbid, I go to sleep and he's not asleep, and then what could happen?
Morris estimates they made nearly 30 iterations of the safety sleeper before she and her husband landed on the final design. The family figured if they benefited from something that stopped their child from wandering, others would too. That meant scaling up. In another part of the factory, Morris shows me her digital plotter cutter.
There's a metal arm that slides across the table. It connects to the software run by the computer over here.
When Abrams Nation started selling the safety sleeper commercially, Moore says her staff would cut the fabric by hand. It took about 2 hours. With the plotter cutter, this stage of production lasts only minutes.
And it is digitized our pattern, so it's going around with a spiral wheel cutting our fabric out.
The warehouse also has industrial sewing machines, what appears to be miles of rolled fabrics, a break room for her staff of 14. Morse got the patent for the safety sleeper in 2011. Today it's bought by families as far away as Australia. And the product line has expanded. Abrams Nation produces occupational therapy aids, weighted lap pads, coats that fit comfortably over people who use wheelchairs. But one thing that's changed is that Abram, who's now a teenager, no longer uses a safety sleeper.
We started letting him transition and tell us how far to zip the zipper or if to zip it or not. And then it got to where he never zipped the door shut and he would sleep with the door open.
That's because, says Morris, Abram now sleeps through the night. I'm Sarah Bowden, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A new exhibition opened this weekend at the Heinz History Center titled The Vietnam War, 1945 to 1975. It features artifacts, stories of the men and women who were impacted by this controversial war, and it also follows the anti-war movement. Joining us in studio are historian and the lead curator of the exhibition, Samuel Black, as well as two veterans from the Vietnam War, Marine, former state senator, former state auditor general Jack Wagner, who's the founder of Pittsburgh Hires Veterans, and John Clark, a Marine, Pittsburgh native, Vietnam War combat veteran, and contributor to the exhibition. Welcome to you all, gentlemen.
Morning.
Morning. Good morning.
Samuel, I'm going to start with you. The exhibition, it expands on one by the New York Historical Society. How so?
Well, we went into a partnership with New York Historical Society, in a sense, convinced them to travel the exhibit. We thought it had a value, and we especially thought that it had value in Western Pennsylvania. So we basically added about 50% of the content in the exhibition. And what we added was primarily the Pittsburgh story. We focused on the Pittsburgh veteran community.
Right. How long of a process was that, gathering the Pittsburgh story?
Typically, and I was telling John this morning, typically it would take us about 2.5 years for exhibition, research, development, and preparation. This was less than a year. So we had a real crash course, maybe about 3 or 4 months of work with the veteran community and deciding on what we thought were good things to add to the exhibit.
John and Jack, did they capture the Pittsburgh story well in this exhibition? Jack, we'll start with you.
They certainly did. There's a wide variety of photos and components of the exhibit. And one of the last items is actually a photo and a name of the residents of Pittsburgh who died in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So that is extremely touching. And that plus interviews of various people at the end, but there's even a UE helicopter inside the building, which is, there's nothing that we Vietnam veterans recall Vietnam quicker than the sound of a helicopter.
Yeah, we want to get to that in a little bit. John, I wanted to ask you, you were involved in helping to formulate the Pittsburgh story, so did you get it? Did you get it right?
Yes, I got it right. Sam Black got in touch with me, and he wanted me to, you know, to bring down some artifacts, so I brought down my uniform. You know, I'm always proud to be in the Marine Corps. Brought down my uniform. When I first got wounded, I fell on a panji stake and it went up through my foot. And I brought that down and some other pictures. And I was proud to let people know that I was a Vietnam veteran and I did what my country asked me to do. And I think the whole exhibit went great.
Okay, I want to talk more about the specifics of the exhibit. But for each of you, what do you think is the biggest misconception that you would like to clear up about the war itself? Sam, let's start with you.
I think that one of the biggest misconceptions is that the Vietnam War was really an ongoing conflict for Vietnamese to decide on which direction that they were going to have their country, whether it was democratic or communist. Coming out of the French colonial system and fighting for their own independence. So in a sense, the United States was involved in the Vietnamese Civil War. Mm-hmm. And I think that, if you look at it from that perspective, you get a different viewpoint and a different understanding of the role that the U.S. had.
We like to look at things from an American perspective. It didn't start in, I guess, 65 when the first American troops were sort of coming on shore. This is in addition to the instructors.
Exactly. The Vietnamese, the French came in at the beginning of their colonial period in 1858, and the Vietnamese were fighting and resisting that since then. So it was at least 100 years of fighting against colonialism before the U.S. involvement.
Mm-hmm. John, what do you hope that, what misconception would you hope that maybe this exhibition clears up?
I'm hoping that the truth to get out. First of all, they said that it was a police action. And we got over there and found out this wasn't a police action. This was a war. So who were the people that was saying this was the police action? They didn't want to do it for political reasons or what? I said, but this is a war. Then you think that the government was behind us. And we got over there, we were given the M14 rifles, which were great. Then after about 4 or 5 months, then they gave us the M16 rifles. And those M16 rifles, you'd fire 3 rounds and the rifle would jam. And you would have to bang it, kick it, and everything to get that rifle to work. And you're thinking you got the government behind you. Somewhere, somebody's getting something for giving us these rifles that don't work. And in my unit, 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines, they had so many complaints going to the family members that they wrote to their congressmen. Mm-hmm. And they sent our unit over VIPs. And they brought all the sergeants in from out in the field, and the colonel, who never even got his feet dirty, said, nobody will say anything bad about this rifle. Mm. And guys was dying. I went down to the armory, man, and I just picked up me a M14 and a bunch of magazines, and I carry two.
So, Jack, biggest misconception you'd like to clear up, whether it's something so specific as a piece of equipment or a broader political vision or what?
There were a lot of unknowns to the general public about Vietnam. John just brought one up. Having your M16 jam, which happened to me, people in my squad died as a result of that. But I think probably the biggest unknown is the bond that we Vietnam veterans have with each other. We really look at each other as brothers and sisters who fought a very ugly war, a war that our country was not supporting, a war where we were up against the Viet Cong, the North Vietnamese Army, the Russians and the Chinese supplying them. So there's an incredible bond of military people who served in Vietnam. And we remember the people who died there. We never forget them. And I think that's what this exhibit brings to life. The service, the commitment that we made to our country. Mm-hmm. And the legacy of Vietnam is one in which we hope the country learns from it, mm-hmm. because a lot of Americans died there.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin, talking about the new Vietnam War exhibition at the Heinz History Center with Samuel Black, the lead curator of the exhibit, and John Clark and Jack Wagner, both Vietnam War veterans. You mentioned a lot of artifacts and mentioned the UE helicopter. I mean, this is a full-size UE helicopter. Jack, you flew in on one?
Well, I flew on UE helicopters, Chinook helicopters. There was a variety of them, but yes, there is a genuine UE helicopter at the History Center. And how they did it, Sam, I'm not sure. But
how'd you do it, Sam?
it's really a magnificent artifact of Vietnam.
Well, we'll have to applaud our colleagues at the Minnesota Historical Society for loaning us that helicopter. It is actually a medical evacuation helicopter that did serve in Vietnam from 1967 to 1970. So it's a real actual artifact. And it came in pieces, actually. And they came in about 20 different boxes and crates on a 18-wheeler. And we moved all those into the gallery before anything else was in the gallery. And the crew came from Minnesota, about four or five men, all veterans, mm-hmm. And reassembled that helicopter. So you basically have about 95%, other than the tail wing, you have about 95% of the helicopter in the Heinz History Center.
John, when you see that copter, what are you thinking?
I was telling my wife, I said, this is a UE helicopter, and we didn't have that in the Marine Corps. The Army had that. Mm-hmm. We had 34s.
What is that, and how different
is that?
That's
a helicopter.
Right, but how different is that from the UE?
It's bigger.
Okay.
A UE is more slim and in attackful mode if you want to attack. Mm-hmm. The 34s were just bringing in troops.
Transport
and taking out the wounded mm-hmm. or dead. Mm-hmm. And that was the big difference. But there was a lot that the Army had that the Marine Corps didn't have. They had better rifles also.
There's also a Marine Corps Jeep in the exhibition. Mm-hmm. So we sort of evened it out with the big equipment.
Yeah,
Army helicopter and a Marine Corps Jeep. Yeah.
Okay. Another display that stands out is a replica of a 60s living room, because this was the first televised war. People back home were seeing film clips of action. We were seeing the numbers reported every night of those Americans killed, the enemy soldiers killed. How do you show in this exhibition what Jack and John, you saw, and Samuel, what you're trying to show through that part of the exhibition? John, we'll start with you.
Just thinking, they just wanted to show what the average household looked like who had members overseas fighting in Vietnam. And that brought home a lot of things, you know, how our apartments looked at that time
right.
compared to what it is today. But it was a good.
Yeah. Jack, when you came back home
mm-hmm.
and, you know, your family been watching sure. whatever they saw on television, how did that mesh clash with what you saw and you told them?
It was accurate. It was the first time in the history of America where the war was in the living room of every home. Mm-hmm. The media did a magnificent job in terms of exhibiting in a real-life way the horrible environment of war. This exhibit does that. Sam and his team at the History Center, Andy Masick, they did a magnificent job. And to have a living room example of what we saw in the 60s and the early 70s is very important, including, obviously, the exhibit shows the demonstrations against the war.
Right.
So it's a real-life exhibit of everything that was going on at that time.
Do you think you got it right in balancing the war as it was fought, the government and its role, and people's reactions supporting and opposing back home, Samuel?
Well, we think we got it right at the History Center, but our visitors will let us know whether we got it right or not.
All right.
The veterans will let us know whether we got it right or not.
Briefly, I want to talk about one more visual image, mm-hmm. photography, that power of photography. And I believe there's a photo or several photos from a New Kensington native, Eddie Adams. Why is that so powerful? What is that image? It's an execution, isn't it? Or a shooting of a Viet Cong soldier.
Yes, it is an actual execution. Eddie Adams from New Kensington was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for that photograph of General Nguyen assassinating the Viet Cong. That was during the Tet Offensive, and that was in Saigon. That image went around the world, and it became an iconic image of the Tet Offensive in 1968. And so not only that image by Eddie Adams, but also images of Dr. Robert Posick taken by Eddie Adams. Posick was also a native of New Kensington and grew up with Eddie Adams in New Kensington. And they meet up again in Vietnam.
Just 2 minutes left. So much to ask you. There is a replica of the Vietnam War Memorial with the names of 752 Americans from the 8-county region who died. Briefly, Jack and John, when you see that, what are you feeling?
You feel the pain, the pain of the people that you knew who died in Vietnam, the people that we served with, and the local residents. A guy I went to high school with died in Vietnam. He's on that wall. Mm-hmm. The other thing that comes to light is that those people never came home. Mm-hmm. And we weren't welcomed home. And that's an important thing to learn about the Vietnam War that doesn't exist today. And I truly believe it's because of Vietnam veterans that environment does not exist.
And briefly, John, what do you see? What wells up in you?
I see the friends that I went to high school with, and then I look past that, and I smell them. I smell them dead. I smell them laying there on the ground, faces blown off, and it's a bad memory for me, and I can't watch it. I can't.
Okay. Just, we have less than a minute left, so very briefly, what do you want the visitors, whether they're our age, whether they're millennials, whether they're students, Sam, what do you want them to take away from this
exhibit? I want them to walk away from the exhibit understanding it was a very complex political situation, but that there were people in Western Pennsylvania who served in that war violently and were real heroes and made our life better today.
All right. Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much. Samuel Black is the lead curator of the exhibition, and it's known as the Vietnam War, 1945 to 1975. Samuel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jack Wagner, John Clark are Vietnam War veterans, Marines. Thank you so much for your service, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And for today, that is the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the risk to patients of false promises about stem cell therapy, and what are the valid uses for such therapies? A talk with Dr. Peter Rubin, co-director of the Adipose Stem Cell Center at the University of Pittsburgh. If you missed anything from today's program, you can find it at wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, assistance by Mick Stinelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.